Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today, our topic is the mystery of bird migration, and I'm delighted to be speaking with Rebecca Heisman, the author of Flight Paths, a new book about the issue. Welcome, Rebecca, and can you tell us more about yourself?
Thank you. I'm a freelance science writer. I write mostly about bird conservation and ornithology, and I live up in Walla Walla, Washington.
Fantastic. How long have you been a science writer? Was this something you graduated school with, or was this your goal?
No, it's definitely a career that I found by accident. I, at one point, wanted to be an ornithologist, a bird scientist, and then I realized, luckily, before I actually started a PhD program, that I liked learning about and writing about and talking about other people's scientific research much, much more than I liked having to be in charge of my own scientific research. And then I actually worked in environmental education for a while. So I have a master's degree in environmental education. And then when I moved to Walla Walla, the small town in Eastern Washington where I live now, I moved here because my partner's job is here. And environmental education isn't just a field where you can move to any small town and find a job doing it right away. And I had been doing stuff with social media and writing and blogging kind of as a side interest for years. And so that was when I managed to move into science communication and science writing as sort of my third career.
Fantastic. But bird science was one of your first interests, right?
Yes, I've been interested in birds forever, but I went from thinking I was going to be a bird scientist to writing about bird science.
Okay, so we have listeners that are very new to the field, new to environmentalism, new to our watershed, new to all the concepts. And we have experts in the field who have their doctors and whatnot in the topics that we cover on this station. So let's start at the very beginning for our newbies, perhaps. What is migration and why do birds do it?
Yeah, actually, I think this is one of those things that a lot of people think they understand, but if they actually give it some thought, maybe they're a little fuzzy on the details. So not all birds, but a lot of birds make these regular seasonal movements between areas to take advantage of, you know, mild weather and food resources that are in different places at different times of the year. And often what we think of are these long distance migrants. These are the ones that like nest and have their babies in North America and then fly all the way down to South America for the winter. There are also shorter distance migrants, birds that are doing this just like within North America from the northern and southern parts. There are even here in the west where we have mountains, there are even what we call altitudinal migrants that might nest up high in the mountains and then move down into the valleys for the winter. But it's just following these sort of seasonal resources across the globe.
Okay, you're right, because we do think of the migration as being a huge effort, a huge journey. And when I teach children, I teach, you know, it come winter, animals have three options. You know, you can hibernate or brumate, you can change how you live, change your colors and change what you eat, or you can get out of town. So
Yeah.
most of us think that migration is getting out of town.
But if you live on top of a mountain, getting out of town doesn't have to mean going all that far. Like I have juncos in my backyard right now, and come spring, those will disappear back up into the national forest to have to make their nests.
And here in Roseburg, we have a huge community of people who wait each year for the fox swifts, I believe they're called.
Oh,
V
foxes, swifts.
Foxes,
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I'm new to them. And we have a chimney in one of our centers here, and that's where they've chosen to stop over every year for their migration.
Yeah.
And so they're not usually with us, and normally they would roost in trees on their way through, but they've chosen this chimney, and it's become an event for us that we go out every night for, oh, I don't know, a couple weeks or something, and watch them come in en masse to this chimney every night, and it's really fun to do. Where are they headed, and how did they know this is a stopover?
I'm not an expert on Vox's Swift's particularly, so I'd have to look up a range map to tell you where they're headed. I don't know exactly what their range is. But yeah, it is really common for birds that make these long distance migrations to reuse these same stopover sites every year. And so a stopover site is just where they kind of pause to rest and refuel before continuing on their way. And it might be something that's just a specific chimney, or it could be, you know, a whole patch of wetland. It can be on multiple scales, if you will. But yeah, these are really important, and it's something that bird conservationists look at. Like with migratory birds, if a species is declining, like its population is trending downward, if it's a migrant, you don't necessarily know whether that's due to a problem on its breeding grounds or a problem on its wintering grounds, or maybe even a problem on at a really key stopover site. So that it's an important thing to understand.
Okay, and I was always wondering, how do they know? even if you don't know about this particular species, neither do
Yeah.
I, how do they all know to come to the same spot? And what if there's a new bird this year? Like he's a teenager. Do they just follow the flock? Is there an instinct? Is there a lead, like in a cattle herd? There's a little lead cow.
That is a really, really good question. I am not sure off the top of my head if we know exactly how birds get back to these same stopover sites year after year. I would imagine there's a certain amount of, social behavior going on. They see that that's what the other birds are doing, and that's what they do as well. As far as just generally, like when and where they migrate to, in a lot of small, relatively short-lived songbirds, we do think a lot of that is genetic, and they've identified genes that seem to be associated with migratory behavior. There's also some evidence that in sort of larger, long-lived birds like shorebirds that migrate in groups, that they are kind of learning this behavior from their flock mates. So it kind of varies a little bit depending on the species. It's nature and nurture.
Then let's go back again to the beginning. Why do we care? Why do we care? And when humans first started noticing birds migrating, why did they care and what did it tell them?
Oh, I think why they cared originally was just because people are naturally curious. These birds appeared, might appear in the spring and then disappear in the fall, and you wouldn't see them again until the next spring. And so, people wondering about this, at least in, sort of the European tradition, goes back to Aristotle, who was the first person to write down some theories about what was going on. Migration does not seem to have occurred to him. He thought that maybe like swallows were hibernating in tree crevices during the winter when he didn't see any. Of course, indigenous cultures have stories to explain why the birds appear and disappear as well. So I think, yeah, it originally just goes back to noticing and being curious, which is something that people are really good at. As to why we care now, it kind of goes back to what I was just talking about, where if a species is declining and you want to help, you have to understand what the problems are that needs fixing. And that means having a really detailed understanding of its migratory behavior if it's a migratory species.
Okay. And I would assume in early days, farmers and people would perhaps look to migrating birds to tell them what's coming up. When is it time to plant? When is it time to close up for the winter? Is that true? Did humans follow birds?
I believe so. I don't know a whole lot about that, but I think that is the case, that that was one thing that used to be used as sort of a signal of, the changing calendar of when certain species appeared and disappeared.
Okay, so how do they know where to go and how do they know that route? I've heard different theories. I've heard the magnet pull of the earth. I've heard smell, and a lot of folk think that birds can't smell, and I think that's being proven more and more so a myth. I've heard following the stars. I've heard following ocean currents. I guess they can read them from above. They can see the currents. I've heard that theory. What do you think they're following? How do they make their way correctly?
So your question is how they navigate, like how to avoid getting
Yes.
lost? Yeah, okay. So a lot of the answer is basically all of the above. They have a lot of different strategies they can use. I am not familiar with the one you mentioned about ocean currents. That doesn't mean it's not a thing. It would probably be a thing specific to seabirds, like albatrosses and stuff. But yeah, migrating birds have a lot of different navigational systems so that if one they can't access for whatever reason, they can fall back on other ones. We know that birds can navigate using the orientation of stars overhead. And this was proven actually, if you're familiar with a planetarium, like you would go to a planetarium show at a natural history museum where they project the night sky overhead. They put birds in little enclosures. This was back in, I think, the 50s or 60s, like in planetariums, so that they could rotate their view of the night sky and see if like the direction that they were trying to flutter in changed. They actually would like put ink on the bird's feet and like line this thing with paper so that as it was like fluttering, it would leave marks along the side of the little
Great.
enclosure that it was trying to go. And then they could see that if they rotated their view of the sky so that if the North Star looked like it was in a different place, they would like switch directions, which is really cool. But sometimes it's cloudy, but you can't rely on that 100%. And they can probably also orient using, like the position of the rising and setting sun. But again, sometimes it's cloudy. So we do know that birds also can sense the Earth's magnetic field. So they can use an internal magnetic compass to find their way. And again, this was first demonstrated by like artificially manipulating magnetic fields around birds in a laboratory and seeing how they reacted. Now, this is one where we've known for a long time that birds can do this because of experiments like that. The question is how? We're still not totally sure how. For a long time, they thought that birds had some like particles of magnetic sensitive minerals in in their beaks
Right.
called magnetite. That's been kind of disproven now. The current theory is that it has to do with quantum mechanics and special blue light sensitive particles in birds' eyes. It's really weird, but birds, so we know that birds can do that. And there's even evidence showing that birds are more likely to get lost and turn up in unusual places when there's geomagnetic storms going on because it
Okay.
interferes with that magnetic sense.
Okay.
Let's see what else. You mentioned smell. There's still this misconception that most birds don't have a good sense of smell. That is absolutely not true. That has been thoroughly debunked. There's a really wonderful book called What Is It? The Secret Perfume of Birds by, I think, Danielle Whittaker is her name, a woman who spent her whole career studying the sense of smell of juncos. Whether they use that for migration, I think is a little bit of a question. We do know that seabirds, and this is technically not migrations, but seabirds travel very, very long distances over the ocean just looking for food.
Right.
I'm saying it's not migration because it's not a regular seasonal back and forth movement, but seabirds can use smells to hone in on like areas with lots of plankton and nutrients in the water from a very long distance away. So they are sort of navigating by smell, like using it to navigate to food that might be very far away.
Right.
So
Okay.
all sorts of different ways that birds find their ways around. We know that sometimes they follow like landmarks that they can see below, like mountain ridges and stuff like that. So many, many different strategies for navigation.
Okay.
That was a long-winded answer to your question.
No, I
Sorry.
love it. So when we first decided, whoever the scientists were who first decided this is a thing happening and let's figure out how it's happening, how did they start to track birds? How did they begin that process?
Yeah, so this is what my book is about, actually, for the most part.
Awesome.
A lot of what we talked so far is just in the introduction of the book.
Right.
So I wrote a book that came out last March, a popular science book called Flight Paths, and it's about the history of how scientists have studied bird migration. Like not just what do we know about bird migration, but how did we figure it out? Because ornithologists have gotten really creative over the years and borrowed from a lot of other scientific fields. I got to write about the Human Genome Project and stable isotope chemistry and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, so your question was, how did we figure this out? So one of the first techniques that was developed, which is still in use today, is bird banding. This
Okay.
is just putting a little metal bracelet with a number engraved into it around a bird's ankle. And it doesn't hurt them any. They don't even notice it once they're released. We catch them in nets that don't really harm them at all. And then if someone else recaptures that bird later, or if it's found dead, they can report the number on the metal band, and then we have
Okay.
some data about where that bird went. Other things that have been experimented with over the years include, like, most songbirds migrate at night, and when they're migrating at night, they make these unique calls that they don't make at any other time. So people have tried putting out microphones to record the calls of these birds passing overhead to see what's flying over at night. Weather radar is a very useful tool for studying bird migration because birds actually show up on radar, and so we can watch sort of large scale continent-wide patterns of bird migration using the nationwide weather radar system. Now we're using things like high volume genetic sequencing to come up with sort of like 23andMe for birds. There's people working on that sort of thing, which is fun. And of course, a lot of what we're familiar with and where a lot of the work being done now is with these various sorts of little tracking devices that you can put on a bird's back and sort of a little backpack that will record or
Oh.
transmit, their location as they migrate.
So, why are they talking at night?
Yeah, so this is songbirds specifically tend to migrate at night. A few different reasons. For one thing, the air is calmer then without the sun warming everything up and creating turbulence. So it's just
Okay.
easier flying. There's less predators out. So, if they need to sit down and rest for a little bit, probably less likely to get snatched up by I don't know, a hawk or something that might want to eat them. So several different reasons why night flying seems to work better for these little migrants.
And you said they have different calls at night, or they speak differently at night. Is
Yeah,
that
some
just to
of
keep in touch with each other and on the right path?
Yeah, so I think this was an open question for a long time. This is another one of these things where we knew that birds were doing this. We didn't really know why. But people have looked at this now and found that birds that follow similar migratory routes tend to have similar nocturnal flight calls, as they're called, even if they're not necessarily that closely related. So the current theory is that it kind of helps them find and stick with other birds that are following a similar route, that there is like a social function to that.
All right, so back on the banding thing, I would
Yes.
assume that would be kind of tricky. You could catch the birds you're catching and band those. What's the guarantee that you're going to see that bird ever again? Is it just an accident that the bird was
Yeah.
found dead, or what's the chances?
The percentages are not high. It varies with the type of bird. Like, it's a lot higher with ducks because there's a lot of people out hunting ducks and they're pretty good
Right.
about reporting bands if they happen to shoot a banded bird. I don't remember the number, but it is a very small percentage of like banded songbirds that are ever heard from again. But because millions and millions and millions of birds well, large numbers of birds have been banded. We've been doing this for a century now. Those numbers do add up. And the other thing is that data from bird banding stations, as they're called, can be useful even if the birds aren't ever seen again, because every time they catch a bird and band it, they're recording. Like, we caught one of this species of bird on this date, and they'll record like its sex and if they can tell its age and its condition and everything. Then we have a very long-term record of, like, from a location, where they've been bird banding for 50 years, we can see like when different species pass through each spring over time, even if we don't see those individual birds again. And so that's where some of the data is coming from that shows us, for example, that spring migration is slowly becoming earlier and earlier and earlier as the records from these bird banding stations.
So a bird banding station, I'd assume you'd go out and let's say you caught 20 birds in this net. Would you band them all? Or, and if not, would you pick one bird over another or several birds over others? Is everybody a good candidate to be banded if they're caught?
Well, it depends. These sort of migration monitoring stations, they're going to band everything. There are, research projects where they might be studying a particular bird, and so they might just release other birds without banding them. But these sort of migration monitoring stations, everything that flies into that net is going to get data collected on it and get a band put on it.
Doesn't matter the age or the sex.
Oh
Everybody
yeah,
gets banded.
that doesn't matter at all.
Okay,
They'll
great. All
record
right.
that data so that we know, but they'll put a band on everything. And there's different sizes of bands for different birds, and it's pretty cool.
And you say this doesn't bother them at all. They don't seem to know.
No, yeah, it's just like wearing a little bracelet around your ankle. It's pretty
Okay.
harmless. Yeah.
And I'm kind of getting off track a little bit here with my questions, but let's
That's
say I
okay.
just found a bird today outside with a band. Maybe my cat brought him in, but it wouldn't be my cat because I wouldn't let my cat loose. But what would I know if I didn't know what I was talking about? Would I know? First of all, I'd recognize a band. I'm sure I'd know something's on this bird. Does it have an ID of like a phone number? How do I know who to call it into?
It used to be a phone number. Now all the metal bands have a website URL on them. I
It
believe
is
it's
a website.
yes, I believe it's reportaband.gov. And so
Awesome.
any bird that you find that has a band on it, in addition to the number, it will have printed in tiny little letters the website that you go to report this band. It's all overseen by the Bird Banding Laboratory at the USGS. It's a federal government program. And you can go and report that, I found this bird and enter in the number, and then it'll give you all the information about like when and where was this bird banded. And I think you even get a little certificate in the mail and acknowledging your contribution to bird science.
I love it. Okay,
Yes,
so
they
it
it
is
used
kind
to
of
be an 800 number and they operated like a call center, and now it's a website.
okay, good. So it is self-explanatory if I find a bird.
Yes,
Oh,
yes.
perfect. Okay, all right. All right, so that's banding and I get banding, but it seems kind of a hit or miss, right?
Yeah, because we've done it's at such large volume, it's been produced a lot of really good data, but it is kind
Good.
of
Yeah.
scattershot.
Okay. But at least from the source where the birds are coming from, basically, we have a pretty good set of data. Where they end up, perhaps we're not catching the same group, but from the source, we at least know who was flying through at the time a little bit.
Well, I mean, it's often just like at some point along their migration. And so you can
Okay.
say at this point, these are the birds that were passing through on this date. But
Okay.
when you have that information for, all of every spring for 60 years, then you can do some interesting things with that data.
Sure. And the next year, if they didn't fly through, you'd know something was up. So at least that gives you some
Yeah.
good information right there.
Or if they came
Okay.
through a little earlier and then a little
All
earlier.
right.
And then
Okay.
you're like, climate change.
I was going to ask about climate
Yes.
change later, but let's ask about it now. Has climate change influenced or changed the way birds are migrating that you've seen or read about?
Yes. And the reason I hesitate is scientists are very, very careful about not mixing up like correlation and causation. So we know that in North America, spring migration has been gradually getting earlier in recent decades.
Oh.
We know this from bird banding stations. I think anyone hearing that and being familiar with the fact that spring is happening earlier and earlier due to climate change, it's not much of a leap. Now,
Great.
the scientists who are, collecting this will sometimes say, like, well, statistically, we don't necessarily have the data, we can't prove that. But I think there is a growing body of evidence that the timing of migration is being affected by climate change. This may sound good, like, okay, the birds can move up they can adjust to climate change. They can move earlier and earlier. It's not clear whether birds can adjust their migration fast enough to keep up with how much earlier spring is coming due to climate change. And so this can throw them into what's called phenological mismatch. Phenology is the fancy term for just the study of like the timing of things in the natural world. And so birds that are migrating from South America up to North America to have their babies, they're trying to like have their babies hatch right when all the caterpillars and everything are emerging.
Right,
So there's lots
exactly.
of food to feed to them. And so if they can't keep up with that shift earlier and their eggs aren't hatching until after that sort of bloom of caterpillars has passed, that might cause some problems. And it's really hard to say for sure that that's happening now, but it's something that's being actively studied to see if that's where we're headed.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know in this area in Oregon, we watch the salmon very carefully. And we have hatchery salmon and we have wild salmon. And the hatchery, I know there were have been some studies on the hatchery salmon migrating early because, for instance, they may have gotten a boost in their growth by being raised in a hatchery, so they got
Oh,
bigger faster.
fascinating. Yeah.
And so they migrate faster. They're ready to go faster than our
Yeah.
wilds. But here's the problem: once they come back up and they lay their eggs or whatnot, the floods haven't come yet.
Yeah.
And so those poor salmon that came early, their nests get washed out
Yep.
because they were too early based on human intervention that got them too big too soon. So
Yeah.
I can see that as your explanation about the birds going before the caterpillars are ready, because
Yep.
nobody told the caterpillars it was coming early this year. So that's
Yep.
interesting. All right, so that's banding. What's the next technology after banding? Have we upped our game?
Okay, so banding is chapter one in my book.
Okay, all right.
Chapter two is nocturnal flight call recording, which I mentioned. And then I
Yeah.
also in that chapter talk about this would get us into a big digression because this is a fascinating technique for figuring out migration that's obsolete now. They don't really use
Oh.
it much anymore. But at one point, they figured out that if you looked at it, these birds are migrating at night. And so they figured out that if you looked through a telescope at the full moon during bird migration, you could see the silhouettes of birds passing in front of the moon. And so they
Oh.
figured out how to do all sorts of calculations just by counting how many birds were passing in front of the moon in a given amount of time. Yeah, from there, we move on to radar, weather radar, and then to all the different types of tracking devices that you can actually like stick on a bird when it's migrating, and then into some of the weird stuff like stable isotopes and genetic sequencing. So I don't know, what do you want to talk about? Oh, and then there's community science, citizen science also.
Well, let's talk about the backpacks. I
Okay.
heard another interview you did, and you were talking about these backpacks, and I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
Tell me about backpacks.
So these are the little gadgets that you can like attach to a bird, often with like a harness that goes around its legs and then it sits on their back. So it is basically a little backpack. Some of them just record the bird's location and they don't transmit it out. And then you have to actually recapture that same bird when it comes back from
Right.
migration the next year to like pull off this device to download the data. Some of them do have transmitters, and so you can, get this information beamed to you via satellite. And there's a lot of different types of these. There's, satellite transmitters. And within that, we've got GPS, and then there's other ways of doing it also. There's radio transmitters, which only have a range of a few miles, but then we figured out how to put up this like network of receiver towers kind of all over the continent so that when a bird with one of these special radio transmitters flies past one of them, it pings it and we can see that this bird was in that location. And then there's what are called light level geolocators, which are basically just a light sensor and a clock and a little memory chip. And so they're estimating a bird's location just based on sunrise and sunset times, kind of using the same methods that ancient mariners used to figure out where they were in the ocean. The advantage of that is that those can be very tiny, lightweight components. So you can put this on a very, very small bird that maybe couldn't carry one of these more elaborate, heavier
Right.
transmitters. But then, like I said, there's no transmitter. So you have to recatch that bird the same year and pull this thingy back off of it and plug it into your computer to figure out where the bird went.
Okay, for these ones that you have to recapture, there's some kind of signal on them so you know in general where they are.
Nope.
Oh, so how do we do this? How do you
so,
catch this guy again?
well, often these migrating birds come back to the same, nesting territory every year. You don't recapture all of them. You just accept that you're going to put a bunch of these devices out one spring and you're only going to get some of them back the next year. So you just kind of cross your fingers that you get enough data back to make it worth the money that you spent on the devices. And yeah, when I was working on my book, I went into the field with someone doing this. He was working in the swamps of Louisiana, and the past spring, he had put light level geolocators on these little birds called Swainson's warblers. And so they had flown down to, I think, somewhere in Mexico. And I was with him as we went out into the woods to try and recapture one of these same birds. And so he'd recorded on a handheld GPS unit, like exactly where he'd caught this bird last year. And so we walked through the woods, and Lucy's like, okay, well, here's the spot where I caught one last year. And he put up a mist net, which is the type of net that you use to catch these birds. And he played a recording of the song of this species because some birds will
Okay.
respond aggressively. They'll think, like, oh, there's another bird in my territory. So he pulls out a little speaker and plays this song, and whoop, this bird immediately flies out of the bush and into the net with this thing on its back that had flown to Mexico since he'd seen it last. It was amazing. It's not
Oh,
always that
cool.
easy, but
Right.
they do that was unusual, but they do tend to come back to the same territory. And you can see, like, you can look at one of these birds through binoculars and see whether it's carrying these, what it
Okay.
has one
All
of these
right.
things on it. So sometimes they'll even be able to look up and see in a tree, like, oh gosh, that's one of our birds. And then they'll spend like 3 days trying to catch this one particular bird, like putting nets all up through its territory and everything. It gets pretty ridiculous. It can be like a battle of the wits between an ornithologist and a tag bird as they try to recapture it.
Right. I remember when I was young, I tried to catch birds all the time. It's not easily done. All right, let's go back to our same 20 birds that we caught in a banding or in a net originally. How many of these units, these backpacks, would they, let's say they caught 20 birds, would every bird get a backpack?
Oh, that's a really good question. So, one thing that they're concerned about is it bad for the birds to have to carry
Right.
this extra weight on migration? And so they follow rules of thumb, like not putting a device on a bird that's more than 3% or more than 5% of the bird's body weight. And then sometimes to test this, to see whether it has a negative effect on whether the bird, lives to return from migration the next year, if they're doing one of these studies with some of these devices, they'll put devices on half of them, and the other half they'll just band. And in addition to the
Okay.
metal bands with numbers, you can do like unique combinations of color bands so that, again, if you get that bird in binoculars, you can see like that's the bird that has the blue, yellow, and green bands. And so then you can see what percentage of the birds that you put the backpack on come back, and what percentage of the birds that just had bands come back. And then you can see if wearing a backpack was, bad, if it made it less likely that those birds would successfully return from migration. So
Okay.
no, sometimes they're not putting a backpack on every bird they catch because they want to compare. And
Right.
also they, these are expensive. They might have only had the research funding to buy 10 transmitters or something. So
So when we say expensive, how expensive do you think a backpack is?
ooh, it depends on the type of device, anywhere from hundreds to thousands of dollars, probably depending on the type and the
Wow.
size and the lifespan. And yeah.
So this is really significant. Okay, another the thing I learned when I was little is some birds, but let's say they have a certain bib on their chest, like a colored bib. And I've heard that some birds, they would do experiments on birds that they'd white out that bib. And so that bird wouldn't look as dominant. And so other birds would pick on it if it didn't
Yeah.
look correct. Do you suppose birds pick on guys that have the backpacks? Do other birds
Ooh.
look sideways at birds with backpacks and treat
Not
them differently?
that I know of. I've never heard of anyone observing that or studying
Okay.
that. I don't think that's really a concern, but that's an interesting
Okay.
question. I think the answer is no, but it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I do remember some birds being an unusual look would be picked on by the rest of the
Yes,
flock.
that's true.
But hopefully these backpacks don't do that.
They're not that conspicuous. They're
Okay.
honestly, if you don't know what you're looking for, they're kind of hard to see. They kind of sit right in against the feathers.
Oh, good. And then again, if I catch a bird with a backpack, I would have the identifying factors that would tell me what to
Ooh,
do
I
with
think
that
the
if I found
chances of
it.
that happening are very, very small. But they
Okay.
do, like, any bird that is going to have a backpack put on it is also going to get a band. So again, you could probably go to reportaband.gov and just enter in, like, by the way, this bird also had a device attached to its back, and someone would probably get in touch with you.
Tell me, what birds are known for their specific long distance migrations? Who's
Oh, that's
famous?
a good question. There is a specific bar-tailed godwit named E7, who, yes, is very, I mean, this was years ago, so E7 is probably no longer alive. Birds don't live forever. But E7, as an individual wild bird, is very famous because she was the first bird where it was documented using one of these transmitters, and this was a satellite transmitter, so they could follow her while she was progressing, that she flew nonstop from Alaska to New Zealand over the Pacific Ocean. Bar-tailed godwits, this is what they always do, but she was the first one where they were actually able to document this. In the fall, their fall migration, they breed in Alaska and then they migrate across the Pacific Ocean to hang out in places like New Zealand and Australia and what have you. And then when they go the other way in the spring, they kind of go up the coast of Asia to make a shorter hop across to get back to Alaska. But that's
Okay.
just about I believe that is the longest nonstop bird migration, like the longest flight without touching down anywhere.
Wow. Okay.
Pretty impressive, yeah.
I understand, butterflies, the monarch butterflies, the famous migrator for the many kids know about. But I
Yes.
do know that those butterflies do it in five stages. So the guy who goes heads down south is not the guy who comes back. So usually they stop halfway, like southern United States, and whoever eventually gets to the end is not, it's five generations of migrations to get a butterfly back up here.
Yes,
But
that
with
sounds right.
birds, it's the same bird, right?
Yeah, it's the same bird flying back and forth. And some of them
And
may only live a few years, but
I was going to say, so f a
yeah.
few years. So does that bird then get a backpack his whole life if we caught him early?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. Yes, some of these devices are intended for the bird to just wear them forever. And some of them have like solar panel, like solar powered battery. There's all different kinds of these things. So there's ones that have solar powered batteries so that hopefully it'll just run forever and we can continue getting data on that bird for its lifespan. Sometimes, depending on the type of device and the type of study that they're doing, they use harnesses or other attachment methods that are designed to wear out after a certain amount of time. Like they just have a limited lifespan and then the straps or whatever will wear through and it will fall off. And then sometimes we're using these ones where the data is logged but not transmitted, and then we're recapturing the bird and actually removing the transmitter.
All right, for our guests just turning in, let me remind everyone this is Living Downstream on 99.7 KQUA. I'm your host, Julie Lowe, and we're speaking with Rebecca Heisman of on the mystery of bird migration. So, how do birds choose their stopover locations? And is it the same? Like I know in Roseburg, Oregon, we have those swifts that come here to our very same chimney every year. How do birds choose a location in general?
I don't
Depending.
know that we really know. I mean, it's hard to study the decision-making process going on inside a bird's brain. We know that they return to the same areas year after year, but how they chose it in the first place,
Right.
that seems like it'd be hard to design a research project that would answer that question.
And I don't know if you know about specific birds, but I was always wondering about these swifts in particular, because that's the one I know about. Is what do they do when they stop? And how long do they stop? But what do they do while they're stopped besides rest?
I don't know that much about swifts
Okay.
particularly, I'm afraid. Swifts are really unique. Swifts, they some species of swifts, they literally don't land for half the year. Swifts are really weird birds. But in general, like songbirds and things, they're resting and they're eating, they're stuffing their face with every insect and seed that they can find.
How long would they stay? Let's go with a songbird or one that you're more familiar with. Would they
Oh,
stay a week?
maybe a couple days, depends on the weather conditions. Because during migration, migration it lasts like migration season lasts for weeks, but there's not an equal number of birds in the sky every night. Like there's
Right.
big nights depending on weather conditions, so they might sit down and even spend several days just kind of resting and eating and waiting for another good air front to move through so they can make a lot of progress.
And I know with our swifts, well, you had mentioned that they travel at nighttime, and perhaps that's because there's fewer predators and perhaps fewer noise in the air. Is that
Yeah,
what you had mentioned?
and also just the air is calmer because during the day there's the sun warming things up and creating turbulence and
The
thermals and
turbulence,
things, and so you
sure.
don't have that at night. The air is cooler and calmer without the sun.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And here, I'm sorry to keep bringing it back to these ones, but they're the ones I observed most recently. We have a couple raptors who
Oh
wait
yeah.
every night and every morning
Yes.
to pick off a couple birds.
Yes. Yep.
So, can you tell me more about new technology that has come out very recently? What's chapter three? Tell me about chapter three.
I should have had my book on my desk. I'm trying to think. Chapter three is radar. So this goes back to World War II, actually, which was when radar first came widely into use, was as an early warning system to detect like Nazi planes approaching Great Britain.
Right.
And pretty much as soon as these radar stations went into operation, they started picking up weird mystery signals that they couldn't figure out what they were, that sort of appeared and disappeared and changed direction. And they actually started calling these things radar angels because they couldn't figure out what was going on. Turns out, of course, they were picking up birds. And so I talk at length in the book about the guy named David Lack, who was the British scientist who was the first guy to figure out that what they were actually seeing was birds. And so now we have weather radar, and migrating birds show up really well on weather radar. And so this has been a really great tool for collecting data on like large scale patterns of bird migration. You can't necessarily identify like individual species of birds, but you can just sort of see, big clouds of birds on radar. And
Right.
so you can see like where and when are the big concentrations of migration happening.
So what if a bird flew through and was picked up by a scientist at the end, the destination location, and he was not banded and he didn't wasn't backpacked or anything? Is there anything scientists can tell about that bird in any other way?
Yes. I have alluded to a couple of these. I have mentioned stable isotopes. This
Yeah,
is
tell me.
probably the weirdest and most technical chapter in the book. I spent like 2 hours on the phone with the scientist, he's Canadian, who first like invented this as a technique for studying bird migration, trying to wrap my head around it. So, gonna see if I can explain this in a way that's intelligible. Hydrogen, we all know what hydrogen is. It's a common element. It's in water. You've got your normal hydrogen, which is what like 99.9 whatever percent of hydrogen atoms are out there are. And then there's a few of them that have a neutron that the other in their nucleus that the other ones don't have, so it makes them a little bit heavier. They're called deuterium, and they're still hydrogen. They can still like form water and do everything that hydrogen can do, but they're a little bit heavier than normal hydrogen. If you've heard of like heavy water, it's water made with this type of hydrogen. And the amount of deuterium that is just in the environment in North America varies with latitude. So as you move north across the continent, there's less and less and less deuterium just around. And this has to do with it like moisture sweeping across the continent from in the ocean, and the heaviest stuff falls out as rain first. When a bird is in a loc is birds molt their feathers once a year. They shed their feathers and they grow new ones. And in the birds that migrate between North and South America do this when they're in North America. It's the other way around in Europe and Africa. But so when a bird molts its feathers and it's growing new ones and it's hanging out in a specific place, eating and drinking while it's growing its feathers, those feathers are inert once they're grown. They don't change. And so the percentage of hydrogen atoms that are deuterium in the environment where that bird is then becomes the percentage of hydrogen atoms that are deuterium in the bird's feathers, even after the bird leaves and flies to a different place. So yes, then you can pluck a feather off of this bird that's migrated to somewhere else and analyze the deuterium content in its feathers and figure out approximately where its breeding location was, where it did its annual molt.
Oh, how cool. All right. Oh, that's cool.
So,
We don't have to kill the bird. We can
no,
just take a feather and
you just
do
pluck
the.
a feather, yeah, and
That's
run it through a
awesome.
big machine in a laboratory.
Oh, that's
Takes
really
like
cool.
5 minutes of explanation of isotope chemistry to get there, but it's really fascinating.
No, that's really neat. So, on the end destination point, you don't have to have all the banding and whatnot done.
The other approach to this, as I mentioned, the folks who are working on what you could think of as 23andMe for birds, where they have mapped, like for a species that breeds all across North America, like they first did this with a little bird called the Wilson's Warbler. They have mapped like genetic variability for like within a species from one place to another across its breeding range. So that then after a bird leaves and it flies, you know, if you catch it on migration or on its wintering range, you can catch this bird and take a feather sample or a drop of blood and sequence its DNA and identify which breeding region this bird came from based on
Alrighty.
its genetic variants. But
Oh
there's a
wow,
lot of
that's cool.
legwork involved because first for each species, you have to do all the data collection and genetic sequencing to like make this map of genetic variation for this species. But they're working on it. It's called the
So
Bird
what?
Genescape Project.
Oh, that's really cool. So what messes up bird migration at night? Just the regular bird flying through. What hazards does it face? What are we doing as humans that might mess up their travels?
The big one, probably as far as what humans do that interferes with nocturnal migration, is artificial light. We don't know why this is. This is another one of these things where we know birds do this, but we don't know why. Birds are attracted to artificial light at night. We don't know why. We just know that they are. So birds, you know, like picture like a big city, like Houston is kind of the classic example where it's right in the path of all these birds that migrate north across the Gulf of Mexico. Then they get to Texas and they fly over Houston and it's all lit up with all these very bright skyscrapers. And so birds are attracted to these lights and then they crash into the skyscrapers and die. This is a big sort, this is actually a big source of mortality of death for migrating birds. And so there are these initiatives now to try to encourage people and businesses who are located in these major migratory flyways to turn out their lights on big migration nights. I mentioned that depending on weather, you know, there's big nights and quiet nights. And so working on predicting when these big nights are going to happen and putting out an alert that everyone should switch out their lights. Now, getting buy-in to this, you know, can be challenging, but people are working on it.
So these birds are flying at night and these lights are attracting them, I guess, like a moth.
Yep.
was attracted to light, perhaps.
Yeah.
How well do birds see when they're migrating? Are they looking for visual cues?
Yes, because I mean they're looking, we talked about they can orient themselves by the stars overhead and things like that. So they do use visual cues.
Because of course it's dark.
Yeah.
But so the lights up above. So yeah, I could imagine if you're looking for the stars and then you have a town below with all those lights, that would mess them up.
Disorienting, yeah.
What about pollution? We've already discussed how birds do in fact smell. They have a sense of smell. I wonder, we all know what the ocean smells like, and I would think that might be a cue for some birds. I wonder what pollution does if that messes them up.
When I think about pollution and bird migration, I don't really think about it interfering with their sense of smell because for, the sort of birds we're talking about, songbirds, I don't think smell is a big component of how they're navigating on migration. Not that they can't smell, they just use their sense of smell for other things. What I think of when I think about pollution and bird migration is pesticides. So, are you familiar with neonicotinoids? These sort of
No.
controversial. So there's this newish class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, and they will actually sort of implant these directly into seeds so that when a plant is grown from this seed, like it will have these pest, de like insect defenses kind of built into its tissues. These things are terrible for birds. If birds eat the, there's a lot of seed-eating birds. If birds eat these
Right.
neonicotinoid-treated seeds, it can actually throw off their migration, we found. Like it can disorient them and cause their migration to get messed up.
I wonder how. Can you hypothesize how
Neurological effects probably
it
does something to
actually?
their brain, I would imagine.
Well, that's scary.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not great.
What about weather? And again, that comes back a little bit to climate change.
Yeah.
When we're getting unusual storms, or let's go with storms.
Yeah.
Let's say we have a huge storm coming in. Does that just make them late for the bus, or does can it really throw off the migration for the season?
Yeah, I mean, they might, yeah, stop and wait for it to pass and then be running behind, or they might get caught in it and blown somewhere really weird and end up way off course, or they might root around it and fly around and have to go a much longer way. This isn't necessarily migration, but just as an example of how birds can get blown into really weird places by storms. We had Hurricane Idalia last year that hit, like Florida. After that, there were flamingos up in the Great Lakes states. A lot of birders in like Pennsylvania
Wow.
and Ohio and Wisconsin got really excited about the flamingos that got blown up to the Great Lakes by Hurricane Idalia. So birds
Wow.
can get blown long distance, can, get caught up in a hurricane or a storm system and get just like swept long distances in the wind, basically.
Let's say that happens to a bird. Let's say one gets thrown way off course. Can they get back on course? Can they find if they got, thrown 2 states away, can they get back onto the path and get on their way to their journey?
I think sometimes, yes, but I think obviously there's probably a greater likelihood of them, dying without managing to do that if they're in an unfamiliar place far away from where they were trying to get to.
Has there been studies where they've taken a flock of, I wish I knew more about birds, a specific bird who always, let's say he always migrates from, let's say, Washington State to Mexico, and we take him to Minnesota and we let him go.
Yes. Yes,
What happens to that bird?
people have done these sorts of experiments. It depends. Sometimes they fly. I'm trying to remember because this is getting a little bit outside of kind of what I've done a lot of research on. But I think sometimes what's happened is that the bird will sort of fly back to its original starting point and then do its migration from there.
Ooh, so he'll
Yeah.
back
So,
up.
yeah. So, but they can sense the Earth's magnetic field. Like they can tell I'm in the wrong place and they can figure out which direction to fly in to get back to the right place. So they can like correct and get back to where they wanted to be. I mentioned that sometimes in larger, longer-lived social birds like shorebirds, there's a social component to migration. And so there's a guy in the Netherlands named Tunis Piersma, who's a famous shorebird migration scientist who took a got these shorebirds godwits that had hatched in the Netherlands and put transmitters on them and drove half of them to Poland and released them into flocks of godwits there to see whether they would migrate like the Dutch birds or whether they would migrate like the Polish birds whose flocks they had been released into. And they migrated with the Polish birds, so it was social. They were following, picking up the migratory routes of the birds that they were around. So I think it depends. It
Oh,
varies
neat.
depending on the species and on exactly what you do to try to throw them off.
Oh, neat. It sounds so fascinating to do. It sounds a little bit cruel, but how, I mean, that's sometimes how science happens. Are there any easy flying strategies for migrating birds? We've all seen the geese who have the V-shaped formation, and from what I understand, the lead goose takes a lot of the brunt of the wind and makes it easier for the birds following him to get in his airwaves and a little bit easier trip. Do you know anything about that? Any strategies for an easy trip?
I mean, I'm familiar with that, and then they take turns being the lead goose. And we talked about how a big part of the reason that songbirds migrate at night is because the air is calmer, and so it
Right.
makes getting on easier. Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot of people, I think this is an active area of research right now because we're just now getting to the point where these transmitters that you might put on a bird can record or transmit not only the bird's location, but also like its altitude above the ground and the barometric pressure and wind speed that it's experiencing.
Right.
So we're just getting to the point where we can kind of collect more data on how migrating birds use things like favorable winds and stuff at a really like granular scale to power their migration.
We're using the word we a lot. Can you talk to me about citizen science and what if you're not trained as a bird person or you don't have access to the technology, how can citizens help?
Yeah, so citizen science, for anyone who's not familiar with this, is this idea of recruiting, non-scientists, everyday people to help collect data for some of these projects.
Right.
And there's a newer term now for this, which is some people are starting to call it community science instead of citizen science because they feel
Okay.
like citizen is kind of a political term and
Right.
anyone can participate in this regardless of whether or not they're, a citizen of a place. So we also hear the word community science. There's a lot of community science programs that do gather data that's used for studying bird migration. One that's been going on for a very long time is called the Christmas Bird Count. Have you heard of this?
I have here in
Yeah.
Roseburg, yeah.
Yeah, so people all over the continent will go out one day around Christmas time and just count all the birds that they see in a day, which doesn't sound terribly, scientific. Obviously, there's a lot of margin for error if it's just a lot of bird, they try to make it as scientific as they can. You have a specific count circle that your group is in charge of, and you record how many miles you walked and drove and how many people there were. But if you we've been do this has been going on for over 100 years now. And so if
Right.
you do this for long enough and you get big enough data sets, you can see trends this way and like what birds are spending the winter in different places. And then now there's also a platform called eBird. Are you familiar with this one?
I've heard of it, but I've never investigated it.
Okay, so this is run by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology,
Okay.
and you can access it via a website or via an app on your phone. And anytime you're outside or going for a walk, you can count all the birds that you see. You can just record what species you see, but the best data is if you try to get if, do your best to get a count. Like, okay, I went for a walk this afternoon, I walked a mile, and I saw six starlings, three magpies, and seven house sparrows,
Oh,
and then
great.
you enter in this data and like, how many birds you saw, what species, and they also went like, how far did you walk or how long were you sitting in one place if that's what you were doing. And then this goes into this database. And so many people are participating in this, submitting their observations, that it's now this enormous data set that they're doing really cool science with, looking in like real great detail about how birds move across the face of the planet over the course of a year and stuff. So if you're interested, you can just type, it's just the letter E and then bird, eBird. You could type this into Google and find it immediately. It's a really cool resource.
Okay, and I follow iNaturalist a lot. I'm a herpetologist, so I enter all
Yes.
my observations into iNaturalist. And then I've also been involved in city nature challenges where everybody in the community goes out for 3 days and records everything they see, everything, every plant, every animal, every insect, every whatever. And we put this in our database and we see which city is getting most populations. Now, I know
Yeah.
there's a big competition among my friends and I about getting the coolest, most unusual, strange species. And if I find another, I don't ever even enter poison oak, for instance, or blackberry, because I assume to myself, everybody knows there's poison oak and blackberry. So is this another problem with birds? Like if I see a pigeon, is a pigeon important enough, or rock dove, as I think they're called, are they important enough for me to enter into eBird?
Yes, is the answer. This is what I was saying, how ideally you want accounts of every bird that you see if you want to enter an eBird checklist. It
Okay.
doesn't, when you go to enter what's called a checklist into eBird, it will ask you, like, are you submitting a complete checklist of all the birds that you saw? And
Okay.
it will let you enter your data even if the answer is no, even if it's just like the birds that you saw that were interesting. But the best, the gold standard is if you really do count all those starlings and house sparrows also and put that in as well.
Okay, so you
Because
don't have to have the coolest bird to enter it. You enter everything.
they want everything. And then birders compete to see, they divide up the, if you go to the website, you can see everyone's statistics of all the bird watchers. So yes, bird watchers compete also, but often it's like who has entered the most checklists in this
Right.
county for the year, or who has seen the most species. Like people absolutely do compete over like who's got the most species for this area in this amount of time. But
Yeah, that's so me. That's so me.
yes,
I
but
would enter
to be a good eBirder,
anything. Right.
you do have to count all the starlings.
Okay, yeah. I would do anything. I would enter blades of grass to get my count up.
Yes.
And of course we have to re rely on folks, on the honesty of people. My family would
Yeah.
tease me about taking some animals out of my own collection of animals and planting them in the field so that I could then come upon them and record that. So we need our citizens to be honest, I assume.
Yes, well, and there are people who volunteer their time to be eBird reviewers, who if anyone submits a sighting of a bird species that's really unusual, this will get flagged and a reviewer will look at it and see if this person added any, photographs or descriptions or anything, and maybe contact the person and be like, "Can you tell me more about this, storm
Awesome.
petrel that you recorded at your bird feeder?" Like, yeah, just so
Right.
they do follow up on that.
And I've heard a lot of stories lately. There are more occurrences of these unusual birds popping up somewhere. Again, I don't know my birds, but the tangier, there's a certain type of really gorgeous tangier out
Oh,
east.
a tanager? Yeah.
Tanager, thank you. Yes, and who's been appearing in strange in the Washington, D.C. area. There was one sighted on in Great Falls, this popular park. Everybody rushed to the park to get a picture of this bird because it was not ever seen in the area. And we had more people in the park for those couple weeks chasing this bird down. Are we finding more occurrences of strange birds arriving in strange locations?
I think it's hard to say whether it's happening more frequently because of, weather disruptions due to climate change or whatever, or whether there's just more people out looking for these things who know what
Okay.
they're looking for and better systems for reporting them, like eBird and things when people do find them, so that we are finding more of them than we used to, or some of both. I think it's hard to
I felt really bad for this poor bird. It was a
know.
gorgeous bird, whatever it was, and really, the population in the park of humans
Yeah.
went up exponentially.
Yeah, I
And
believe
I
it.
and I wonder how that affected that bird. Like,
Yeah, it's a good question.
it was normally a quiet park, and we had crowds and crowds and crowds and crowds chasing and literally chasing this bird because they
Yeah.
wanted a good picture. So I thought that was fascinating. Is when birds are migrating, is there a way we can help or hinder them? I've heard that a lot too about, for instance, hummingbird feeders. Do you fill up your hummingbird? Do you not fill it up and make them force them to go on their journey? Or do you fill up your hummingbird feeder and give them more energy for their journey? And when do you stop?
Yeah, I've heard that question about hummingbirds, and I'm not sure that there is a definitive answer to it. I think if you ask me how you can help
Right.
migrating birds, putting out bird feeders is definitely not the first thing that comes to mind.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, for one thing, this isn't everyone, but I think a lot of people don't understand the level of maintenance that goes into keeping bird feeders like safe and sanitary. Like you're but like you Bird feeders can be a place where disease. I'm not talking about hummingbird feeders in particular, although even those you should be running through your dishwasher once a week. But like bird feeders can be a place where diseases can spread from bird to bird very easily. And so really, if you have a like a seed feeder, you should be like bringing it in and dunking it in bleach on a regular basis. And I think a lot
Okay.
of people put out a bird feeder for the winter and don't know that that's a thing that you're supposed to be doing. So when I think of things that people can do to help migrating birds, I think of keeping cats indoors.
Okay.
You
Of
mentioned your
course,
cat
yeah.
already. I have a
Yep.
cat. He's asleep on the couch behind
Yeah, I
me
saw
here.
him.
Yeah, he's back there, but
Yeah.
he's an indoor kitty. So, and people don't like to hear this, but outdoor cats are actually one of the top sources of mortality for birds in North America. Even if your kitty cat never brings home birds, that doesn't mean that they're not killing them and then leaving them out there somewhere. So keep your
Right.
cats inside. We talked about light, and I mentioned window collisions. This can happen at people's houses too, if you have a big picture window, because birds have good vision, but it works differently than ours. And if they're seeing like the reflections of plants and stuff, they're not going to realize that there's glass and they'll go flying right into it.
Right.
So there's products you can buy that are like little rows of stickers and stuff that you apply to your windows to make them more visible for birds. So window treatments, especially, people know if they found dead birds around the base
Right.
of their picture
Right.
window. Like if you have a window like that, thinking about doing something. Planting native plants in your yard, I think ultimately, if you have the time and resources and motivation, I think planting native plants that produce seeds and support insects and create more like natural bird food is probably better than having a seed feeder out there. I mentioned neonicotinoid pesticides. If you go to
Right.
Home Depot, some of the plants that are for sale in the home and garden section are neonicotinoid treated, and it will say that on a tag somewhere. So make sure that you're not, putting neonicotinoid treated plants in your landscaping, things like
Okay.
that. Yeah, so reducing your use of pesticides in general. So yeah, things like that. And then also, honestly, calling your legislators and advocating for more, sound conservation policies, things like that. And if
Right.
you look up your state Audubon chapter, every statewide Audubon chapter has, bills that they're advocating for in the state legislative session, things like that. So you can pretty easily get plugged into like how to call up your legislator and what bills to be arguing in favor of.
And do you know, are we helping or hurting them when we put out food for their journey? Like I literally heard that people say that hummingbirds won't leave if you keep feeding them and they need to leave and get out of town.
I don't know off the top of my head whether that's true for hummingbirds.
Okay.
I know that where I live in Eastern Washington, we have Anna's hummingbirds now that spend the whole winter here, which is a relatively new development. And a lot of bird enthusiasts like put out like heated hummingbird feeders. Like they'll put a
Right.
little heat lamp on there to keep it from freezing. And then they'll have like four Anna's hummingbirds that they're like nursing through the winter. And so I suspect that in cases like that, like obvious, like would those birds be here in the winter if there weren't
Right.
hummingbird feeders around? Maybe, because hummingbirds will eat insects in the winter too to get enough calories. Yeah.
Oh.
I think if you have a hummingbird feeder and you enjoy the hummingbirds, you're not like causing large amounts of harm to the hummingbird population, as long as you're cleaning your hummingbird feeder regularly so that they're not getting sick.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. All right, so one more time, why do we care? Why birds migrate? Does it help us understand anything from the bigger perspective of the animal world, our world? Why is the migration, why does it speak to something more than what specific birds are doing?
Oh, people just find it inspiring. I don't know. Is there any better sign of spring than the return of
Oh,
all the
right.
colorful, beautiful little songbirds? People love it. And then we also care because we care about, the extinction crisis and the declines of many species that are going on. There was a paper that came out a few years ago now where they drew on a lot of different sources of data and came up with an estimate that there are 3 billion with a B fewer breeding birds in North America now than there were in 1970. So that's about a 30% decline just in the total number of birds
Right.
living in North America.
Right.
And so that is just staggering. And that includes all North American birds, not just migratory birds, but obviously a lot of these losses are among migratory birds. And if we want to reverse those population declines, we have to understand what the problems are that are causing them. And for migratory species, that means understanding their migratory behavior in a lot of detail so that we can
Right.
figure out, is it a problem on their breeding grounds? Is it a problem on their wintering grounds? Is it a problem with their stopovers? So we need all of this data to kind of figure out what habitats they're using and what they're doing over the course of their whole annual cycle so that we can figure out where we can intervene and make a difference.
Can you tell me one more time the full title of your book?
It has a long subtitle. I have to admit, the subtitle is my publisher's invention. So it is Flight Paths: How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solve the Mystery of Bird Migration. But yes, Flight Paths, it was published by HarperCollins, and you can find it online or order it through any bookstore. And then I also have a website, RebeccaHeisman.com, where you can sign up for my monthly email newsletter and find links to buy my book and find links to other writing that I'm doing, all that sort of thing.
Fantastic, Rebecca. This has been fantastic. This has been so informative for me. I've enjoyed our time together so much. Let me remind our listeners. This has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Rebecca Heisman and the mystery of bird migration. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any interview in our series, you could find past episodes at umpquawatersheds.org, and thank you for listening.